Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine Podcast Radio. You're about to listen to a new redefining technology podcast. Standing on 2 feet, having dexterous hands, developing a language that allows us to communicate, and the ability to understand abstract concepts. These are all part of the equation of humanity. Still, it is the capacity to create tools and advance the technology that has allowed us to thrive on this planet, and maybe on others. Knowledge is power, now more than ever. Blue Lava is the first business platform for CISOs to manage their security program. Blue Lava guides security leaders to effectively measure, optimize, and communicate their security program with confidence and ease in one platform. Learn more at bluelava.net.
Marco.
Sean, I think I know what you're about to say.
Do you know? Because I'm going full circle again. No, it's time to go full circle.
I thought you were going to say we're running in circles.
I think we are running in circles. The question is,
are we going
running in circles to nowhere, or are we running in circles to what the dinosaurs experienced? That's a question.
Well, I guess in this case, as we are in our channel called Redefining Technology, I think that circle takes an entire different meaning. And in this particular case, we're talking about a circular economy and all that it means for our society, for our business, and for technology itself. So it's a very important conversation, and I think it will be applied to many different industries as we go. But today we're going to start with one in particular, and we have a guest to do so.
Exactly. So we're going to be looking at the circular economy for construction and building, and thrilled to have Professor Ushan. Thanks for joining us, Professor. Looking forward to having a great conversation with you.
Pleasure.
Definitely to learn something.
I'm hoping to learn something. I don't want to run in circles anymore. Let's start off, Professor, with a few words about some of the things you're working on. I mean, you have a lot of hands in a number of different things. So maybe share a few words about who you are and what you're up to.
Sure. So I am a professor at the School of Property Construction and Project Management at RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia. I also have been working for the last 6 years with a program which is rebadged a couple of years ago to what is now called as the One Planet Network. The program was set up as a result of, I suppose, a recognition that we're not doing enough in terms of changing the way we need to move and accelerate the pace of change towards sustainability. And it came out of a number of conferences, for instance, the RioPlus20 conference in 2012, that made us realize that we need to do things a little bit more differently. And there were certain areas that were cherry-picked. So this was even before the Sustainable Development Goals were set up. So buildings and construction is one area that really is increasingly getting a lot of attention. And the reason for this is because buildings do have a major impact on the planet. When we use sand for buildings and construction, there is an impact that sand mining has in local communities. It has an impact on biodiversity. So this program was launched in 2015, the Sustainable Buildings and Construction Program, as part of one of six programs across the One Planet Network. And as part of this program, we're particularly interested in sharing our learnings from the developed world into the developing world. So essentially, we want the developing world to fast track in a different direction so that they don't repeat the same mistakes that we have in the developed world. So we don't want to lock in all the mistakes that have already been done, but rather show them a different pathway so that they can move towards sustainability in a different way and in a much more considered way than the developed world has followed.
Yeah, I love that, and a huge mission there. And maybe if you can help set the stage for us, when I think of a green world where we're trying to do things to save the planet, the first thing that comes to mind is emissions, and there's a lot of focus on that. But you just described a situation of sand mining and using the sand to build stuff, and I'm sure there are a gazillion examples of that. So can you kind of paint the picture for us of what a circular economy means, how that relates to a world that's green friendly, and you use the word sustainable as well, which may be something completely different. So how does this fit in? Does it overlap all of that, or kind of paint that picture if you wouldn't mind?
Sure. So let's start with circular economy. Circular economy, basically, there are a number of different definitions, but essentially what it means is to ensure that the waste, what we call as waste, which is something that people don't need or don't want anymore, that gets reused, recovered, repurposed in some other way so that it doesn't end up in the landfill. So it doesn't end up in the oceans, it doesn't end up in landfill. And we need to find a way to ensure that waste, or from a circular economy perspective, it's a resource, can get reused back into the system again. Now, let's look at the parallels between circular economy and sustainability. If you look at the Brundtland definition of sustainability, it talks about ensuring that the planet is providing resources for current generations and future generations. So it's covering across environmental issues, economic issues, and social issues. Because the circular economy, the starting point is often economic, and it talks about the reuse of resources, there are lots of parallels between the circular economy and sustainability. And if you look at resource use and resource efficiency of the environmental part of sustainability, we're talking about the same thing. So even though the Sustainable Development Goals, which were launched in early 2016, the 1st of Jan 2016 to be exact, has 17 goals, a number of different targets and indicators to assist us in meeting these targets. There are over 240 indicators that assist in meeting these targets. Nowhere in any of these indicators, targets, or goals is there mentioned specifically about circular economy. But the principles of resource efficiency that sustainability is based on and the principles upon which we are operating the circular economy are the same. So when I'm talking with you, and often when I talk with students, with peers, with businesses, etc., I interchange circular economy with sustainability. But for me, where circular economy resonates, particularly with the business world, is the economic underpinning. So it provides a positive outlook that there is an opportunity here for us to recreate how we do businesses. There's an opportunity here for us to innovate in how we do things and do things differently. And I think that's what we need, particularly in a post-COVID world, where we have realized that global supply chains can come to a halt. And it has impacted, and our reliance on global supply chains has impacted all of us, including the production of vaccines. So if we move to a circular economic way of thinking, which is thinking about procurement patterns, thinking about the relationship between planning and design, thinking about materials use, local supply chains, local materials, local repair, local jobs, I think we can reinvent the way this whole current system has been locked in. And there is an opportunity, a huge opportunity waiting for us to see how we can make the best use of this opportunity so that we can quickly move towards a direction that in the past has led us to emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, has led us to obviously pollution, but pollution in oceans, and also has led to a social milieu that is unequal. So I think if we move in this direction towards a circular economy, I think we would be hitting not just the environmental brief, but also the economic brief as well as the social brief.
Yeah, this is an interesting point, and I think we need to dig a little bit deeper into some case studies, some examples, some of the things you've been maybe focusing and the entire community is focusing. But before we get there, I'd like to ask you something that is a curiosity in terms of more of a, how we got here and how we didn't talk about circular economy before. I mean, we've been building for a long time. We've been manufacturing for a long time. And as a society, we have a tendency to just, you know, keep our heads down and move ahead until we hit the wall, and then we have to think a different way to get there. But also sometimes is the converging, especially with technology, when multiple technology converge in a certain state of advancement, that's only when it's possible to actually change the way that we do things. So my question is, how much is a mental approach and how much is that certain things could have not been done before with the technology that we had before?
It's a really great question. So let's go back. I mean, I'm in Australia. Let's go back 60,000 years in Australia, where the First Nations people lived in this country. And they lived, in my view, in a very circular way. They actually didn't even build buildings. They touched the earth very lightly because they moved often from place to place, depending on the season, to allow the earth to regenerate. I mean, how much more circular can you go than that? Now, let's go through the ages and, you know, the different ages, the Stone Age, the Bronze Age, and then, of course, the much later one, which is the Industrial Age. And what we have called as advancement of humanity. And of course, we have advanced in a number of different ways. But there are lots of things that we can also learn in the process. As soon as we started building, the process of building itself does two things. One, it gives people a home. So it gives people, almost nails people down to a place. That's one. But also, the process of building and construction has an impact on the planet. We, going back to the Stone Age, stones. So they were the material that was used in the local areas. And then as we became more sophisticated, started using bricks. Bricks are made out of clay. So again, that's taken from the local area and use of different types of stone, marble, sandstone, et cetera, et cetera. And then when we moved 200-300 years ago to the industrial era, and what that has led is this mass production on a very linear basis. So we move very quickly from thinking about, so even though we stayed in places, people went away from, you know, armies marched in from cities into another city, but they came back. So there was a certain level of acknowledgement that you would still eat local. So you would use the food that was manufactured in a local basis. You would use materials and clothes that was manufactured in a local basis. But with the advent of industrialization, everything has moved to mass production. And I think this has been our downfall, which of course we didn't realize at that point in time. And what mass production has done and the pursuit of profits leading or resulting from mass production has resulted now in wastage of fashion. You know, people buy clothes they use maybe once or twice, has led to us buying materials of food. I can buy anything I want in any season I want because of global supply chains. When it is wintertime here, it is summer in another part of the world, and I could get summer fruits, such as mangoes, from another part of the world delivered into Melbourne. So this has led to an expectation of production and consumption patterns that we have recognized now as being no longer sustainable. So it's not just buildings, it's not just people, but it's also our lifestyles. You know, a typical Australian home would be 300 plus square meters, and you might find only two people living in there, maybe three people living in there. So we have completely, I think, changed our goalposts into what is important and what is relevant. And I hope I'm not sounding very spiritual here, but I think this is an important discussion to have, because as cities grow, and particularly cities of the new growth regions of the world, cities in Africa, cities in Asia, cities in Latin America, they are going to be the new age cities as we look towards 2050 and 2060. And imagine if those cities, having populations of over 6 million, some cities 10 million or more, are all going to be adopting lifestyles that we have now in the Western world. Australia, at the moment, our ecological footprint is so bad. We need something like 8 planets to live the life of an average Australian. If an average African and an Asian and a Latin American does that, what will happen to us? We just can't afford it.
Yeah, where do we go from there? And I want to dig into this a little more, Professor, because what I'm picturing here is the Industrial Revolution, a lot of new technological advances enabling us to create things on a massive scale, deliver them, deploy them, to ship them all over the world at scale. And I think that we've changed the way we live. Our society's changed, our lifestyle has changed, the way we think has changed because of technology. And that's primarily in the physical world of creating things and building things. And we're now at a point where we have the digital revolution, which allows us to do all of that even faster and also create more technology even faster, which I believe is going to further change who we are as a human species. So thoughts on where you think we sit now with new technologies putting us in new situations that we may not recognize or be prepared for?
Another great question. So technology over the last 20, 30 years has really progressed in leaps and bounds. And technology can be our friend. And I think technology should be our friend. So imagine in, say, maybe 10 or 20 years, we are able to build buildings where we know exactly what chemical composition is in our wall, our floor, ceiling, etc. Imagine if we know exactly how much material has gone in. Imagine if we know in 30 years' time, if I decide that I don't like this place that I live in and I want to build something or move somewhere else, but I want to get rid of my house, imagine if I'm able to dismantle, deconstruct my house into the various components that my house was built into, and I could sell that off to somebody else, ship that off to somebody else. We're talking about a revolution in the way we change, the way we think of buildings and construction. And this is really, really important, because I gave you the example of sand mining and the impact on biodiversity. We cannot afford to continue to mine the planet And this is where circular economy becomes really important. We don't want our cities of the future to use virgin materials as we have been using over the last 50 years, 100 years, and so on, in building the cities of the developed world. We want the cities of the developing world to be using materials that are already in the system so that the extraction, the pollution, and the biodiversity impact as a result of the extraction, at least, is reduced, if not totally eliminated. And then if we are able to use materials in the system, discarded material, so typically, when a building is built, there is an over-specification of materials. Sometimes that can go up to 8%, 10% even. What if we can use technology to reduce that? That would be absolutely fantastic. So immediately you've got a savings of about 8%. What happens if we are rebuilding our buildings, refurbishing them, and we're using materials that were torn down or were pulled apart in the process of refurbishment? So here's another opportunity. So we don't need to rely, again, totally on new materials and virgin materials. And what happens if we create warehouses or areas where people can actually go in and shop for materials that have already been discarded through the processes of building and construction? There's a lot of building and construction waste that's generated. And at least in the Australian context, that waste has been increasing over a period of time. And that has been increasing largely because we're building more, we are a growing population, we're continuously, particularly in housing and infrastructure, we do a lot more building. But what happens if we use technology in this process? That is going to eliminate a lot of the inefficiencies that we have currently in the system. So if we move, food labeling is a great example of how it tells us the nutrition. Open a box of cereal or buy a box of cereal and it tells you what the nutritional value is. Now, people may or may not agree with it. That's another debate to have. But it tells you how much sugar, how much fat, how much sodium, et cetera, it has. Imagine if we do that for our buildings and all the things we use in buildings. So we use appliances as well. When you typically build buildings, as we become more and more energy efficient in the operation of buildings. So buildings typically last anywhere between 50 to 100 years, sometimes even more. And as buildings are becoming more and more efficient in terms of their operation, the focus naturally will shift when you consider from a whole life cycle perspective into how buildings are built. So we need to get smarter and better with our building practices. And with the advent of technology, we have now got 3D printers, we've got prefabrication, we've got building information modeling technology. So all this has a potential to completely change the way we do things. But unfortunately, I think the building and construction industry is a dinosaur when it comes to adapting and adopting change for a number of reasons. One is because the buildings and construction sector is a conglomeration of different disciplines and different stakeholders that come together. And their purpose is to build something. And when that is built, they just go away and do something else. So that knowledge and innovation that often takes place in a building is retained in the hands of a few and sometimes not even passed down to the person who is managing the building. So if you're talking about commercial buildings and office buildings, usually a building would have a number of different tenancies. There'll be a building manager. So sometimes even the building manager may not actually be able to exploit all the innovation that has taken place in a building. So there's a lot of education and upskilling and skill building that needs to take place. And imagine if you're also giving homeowners manuals or tenants manuals on how best they can use their spaces within their buildings. That will revolutionize things down the track to a very large extent.
My mind is exploding right now because I want to go in so many different places. I'm thinking,
me too,
the building blocks of the universe and how, you know, we reutilize the chemistry of the universe, right? Reassemble, like when you're explaining a home, you can decompose the all the material that's been used to a home. I'm going there, and then I'm thinking 3D printing, and how we actually had a podcast, not from us, but one of another host on this about 3D printing and how it's actually used by NASA to conceptualize printing on the moon or other planets by using the resources that are on that planet, because you can't bring it there. Of course, try to load, you know, cement in a rocket, you know, you're going to need so much fuel. So this whole thing, you know, it's almost futuristic to think about. But you also brought some very concrete example of what we stand and what the technology right now is. Can you paint even a more specific picture of how is this dinosaur moving, you know, in today's world? Because a lot of is the future is we can do this, we can do that. But what are we actually doing now to change things?
Well, look, there are examples of optimism in here, but they're very much what we call at the outer edge. So they're very much in the innovative demonstration phase. But where we need to really move, and the challenge lies in moving those great examples, great demonstration projects into mainstream. That's where we need to be. We need every expectation from a consumer should be not a new home, yes, but not necessarily new materials. The materials can be materials that could have been reused, recycled. There's technology now that's using plastic litter into building blocks. And there are examples of this in Africa, there are examples of this in Asia, there are examples of this in the developed world. But that needs to become mainstream. So the problem, and I'm sure this is not just the building and construction industry, the value chain of the building and construction industry is very intricate. And all players along the value chain need to be prepared in the right mindset to be able and prepared to embrace this technology. And currently, that's why they remain, all these examples remain as the outlier or the demonstration project or an example of innovation. If we have to move to mainstream, it means that building codes need to change, policies need to change, and every country and even within a country, different states, different jurisdictions have different policies, different codes, different regulatory needs, different regulatory expectations. And so you need this whole system to change in order to be able for us to fast track so that innovative technologies can be brought in very quickly. And with some of this innovative technology, I mean, you know, we've seen, for instance, we've seen how Uber has changed the world with in relation to car sharing and car riding, right? But there's a huge debate, at least here in Australia, about particularly around the food sector and the delivery, the different mechanisms, Uber Eats and Deliveroo and so on. There's a huge debate here as to socially, there's a lot of pressure being placed on these workers, and a number of people have lost their lives as a result of moving quickly from one place to another. They don't have any, there is no union, they don't have any legislation which supports them and protects them. So The reason I'm giving that example is it's great to think about technology as being a carrot in the way things can be changed and being a critical catalyst for us to move in the right direction. But this comes with a caution. We also need to ensure that the technology doesn't become an end in itself, but the technology is actually delivering the social benefits that we're after and the environmental benefits that we're after. So it becomes, I think, you know, the research in this space is just as important. And you know, we're talking in Europe because Europe's, generally speaking, European population is reducing. And so there is a move in the European Union to talk now about buildings to be readapted. So office buildings, if they're vacant, to be readapted for housing. And particularly in a post-pandemic world, where possibly we're not all going to be going into the office to work because we have now discovered that we can work well from home. And so the home also becomes an office. And so, you know, there are different sets of priorities that we need to start thinking about. And we need to start thinking about all these buildings that we have invested in, particularly over the last 20 years, 30 years. How are we going to make the best use of these buildings? So we need technology, yes, but we also need social innovation. So we can start thinking about the social innovation to assist us so that the technology fits in the right way as well. So if you're going to be readapting the uses of some of these buildings, are people prepared to move into buildings that were once offices? How can we readapt these? Because we don't want to tear them down again and rebuild. Because if we do, then from a circular perspective, we're not trying to make the most of our strategy of an existing building. So these are some of the discussions and debates that we need to have. And it needs to move into mainstream. It cannot just sit at the edge, because if it stays at the edge, it'll only be at the edge. It needs to move into everyday thinking. So that needs to become standard practice over a period of time.
Yeah, and I think as you're describing all of this, and I mean, it's complex, right? Trying to figure out how society will want something and we may or may not be able to deliver it, and what we need to do may not fit the way we think right now. So I'm wondering, given we're really looking at technology and how to redefine technology in this channel, what do we need to do to change how we look at technology, and how does the technology need to change such that it serves us versus the other way around?
I don't know if I have a direct answer for this question, because I think as humanity, we are still trying to grapple with this. In terms of the technical side, I remember having a conversation with someone from a telecommunications company when we were talking about having track and trace, you know, the RFID codes in building materials. And the response that I got was, oh, that's so easy. It you know, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to do that. But then the discussion then moved to, where do we start? How do we do this? How do we set up systems in place so that all these different technologies can also talk to one another? Because a building would, you can imagine, would have so many different materials, so many different components that go in. There could be a million different things that go into a building. Are these different bits of technology in a position to talk to each other? Do they talk even in the same language? And how do you convert that from a piece of technical code into something that the architects and designers, that the people who construct the buildings, builders, you know, the, and down the chain, the facility managers, into the homeowners, you know, so but I don't want to sort of sound gloom and doom. We have been using, and there are examples to show, you know, using Siri and pardon me, Alexa, you know, examples where you can say, Alexa, turn the television off. Alexa, dim the lights. Alexa, drama curtains. So, you know, some of this is already being used. But again, it's a question of how do these different components fit together, work together, and move in the direction of ensuring that people across all the age groups, you know, boomers find it really hard. And just something that popped in my head, which I think is really important and relevant for this context. Here in Australia, we have now moved, and particularly here in Victoria, we have moved to a QR code system as a result of COVID. And this is to assist with contact tracing. So if there is a community spread in any one place, it's easy to contact people who have been involved in that space or have visited that space, so we can track and trace them if we need to as a result of COVID. Now, the QR code system, a lot of people know how to use it. But what is surprising is that a lot of people don't know how to use it. So a lot of people have been taking their camera and actually taking a photo of the QR code rather than using the camera to open the QR code into another platform and then filling in the information. So here is just a very simple example and a very relevant example, I think, in the context of buildings as well, that there are so many different components and so many different people involved in the stakeholder chain that they all need to be in sync. And they all need education. They all need to know how to use the system. Only then can we be in a space where we're all talking the same language, we're all on the same page, and then we can undertake research to allow us to understand, have we met what we wanted to? Have we met the triple bottom line, the environmental benefits, the social benefits, the economic benefits, and where to from here? So there is still a lot of work that we need to do.
Yep, and I'm picturing swirling a cyclone as a circle, or mixing a nice, delicious smoothie. I'd rather have the smoothie over a cyclone. But I guess my point with that is, if we don't pause and stop and take a look at what we're doing, we'll never start. Right, we'll just continue. So we'll never start. I think, to your point, it's very complex, right? Everything you said, everything has to be in sync for even just that one example. And there are countless examples of things we want to accomplish to remain sustainable in on this planet. But we have to start somewhere, and the first steps, whether it's policy, whether it's greed, whether it's societal drive and demand, something has to start somewhere. Perhaps as a closing comment, one resource, if you could share, I don't know if it's work you're doing at the UN or something to give somebody listening a place to start. Professor, if you would, please.
Thank you. There are a lot of resources that are available on the One Planet Network website. So I would encourage people to go and have a look at the Sustainable Buildings and Construction Program of the One Planet Network. We have podcasts, we have research, we have education, we have tools. We have a whole range of different things that would help people. But I also want to sort of touch upon what I said earlier and also what you said there, Sean, which is, we can't really afford to sit back and do nothing. The latest Intergovernment Panel on Climate Change has made it absolutely clear that if we do nothing, we are heading definitely towards a warming planet. And as we head towards a warming planet, it's going to become more of an issue for buildings and construction, because a lot of the building codes have been set up based on expectation of weather. So if the weather is really cold, and in Australia, if you're sitting in a particular, or anywhere in the world, if you're sitting in a particular zone as far as a cold temperate climate is concerned, and if you're suddenly moving into, over time of course, but if you're moving into a much warmer zone, then your implications for the way you build the way your cities and your houses are constructed is also going to change. And so there is a historic baggage that we're drawing with us. And as we move into a more uncertain world, as far as weather events are concerned, which also leads to more hazards, it also calls upon the importance of being resilient as a result of this. So it is really, really important for us to now say, we cannot afford to not do anything. We've got to move. We've got to start. And yes, it's going to take us a lot of time and effort and goodwill to get the bits of the pieces of jigsaw to fit well together. But God, we've got to start. We've got to start now, because the generations after us will be the ones who will inherit a very broken planet. And it's not fair for us to leave the planet in the condition that it is now. We've got to start the process of mending. We've got to start the process of making that change.
Yeah, and it seems like we've gone from a human race that has been constantly on the move to one that we're preparing ourselves to be locked down with baggage where we can't. All right, Marco.
Yeah, many comments in my head, but one that I just have to say, it's that the linear way of thinking is what brought us to consumerism. And not planning, just like, oh, I'm going to buy these, I'm going to make this, going to be forever, I have infinite resources on this planet, we're going to be here forever, climate's never going to change, and so forth. Let's make cars, pollute, who cares? A circular thinking and a circular economy, I think it implies a plan. And I think that starting somewhere means to start to have a plan on how to go from here. I'm making a circle with my finger for the podcast listener, and go back. It's almost like our dear friend says, Sean, we send people to the moon, but we brought them back too. We needed a plan for that, right? And with that, I agree with you. Let's keep moving. To all the listener, those resources that you mentioned are going to be on the notes in the podcast. And so please read about it, comment on social media. And Professor Husha, thank you so much. I love this kind of conversation. Yeah. So anytime, we'll love to have you back and talk more about this.
Thank you, Marco. Thank you, Sean. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Blue Lava is the first business platform for CISOs to manage their security program. Blue Lava guides security leaders to effectively measure, optimize, and communicate their security program with confidence and ease in one platform. Learn more at bluelava.net. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Redefining Technology Podcast. If you learned something new and this podcast made you think, then share itspmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.